The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. This is our rant numero
three.
And today we have the pleasure of having a repeat guest, a good friend of the podcast, Jill Somerset. And I guess today we're going to be focusing on the value of ultrasound in the perioperative management. We wanted to get all the way to the postoperative management, but we didn't make it. So it'll be pre and intraoperative. And then we'll leave postoperative management care and surveillance that we're going to have Brian Lipo for that one come back and do another one. So that would complete the four series that we wanted to do on arterializations. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and tune in.
Yeah, enjoy.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
Thank you so much for being here, Jill. As I've told you and Miguel multiple times, one of these days I'm going to kidnap you and just keep you at work so I can have all these beautiful ultrasound images, but I think that's illegal.
You're going to have to fight a lot of people.
I know. But I think I can take you on.
You're going to have to fight Maria. I think I can take you on. Maria, you're going to have to fight me. You're going to have to fight some other people. Mm. And Jill doesn't like to spend time with the hippies in Austin.
Looks like a hippie. Jill, you would do so well in Austin. You live in Oregon. What are you talking about?
That's true. That's true. Well, thanks you guys for having me on the podcast. Number one, I am a huge fan. I listen to every podcast, and half the time I'm probably crazy because I'm talking back to you in my car about your podcast, especially on DVA Rant 1 and 2. So I'm very happy to be here.
Which has been one of your favorite shows? I guess you just answered.
To be honest, the rants are my favorite, but gosh. Courtney Johnson, this last couple, and
Courtney Johnson. So good. We may have a star appearance right now. Look at that. That was funny.
Okay. So I literally am like, I need to follow her advice. I'm going to start to do a little bit of posts on LinkedIn and follow like,
no, you
her,
should do,
her,
you should,
so thank you.
You should do your, some of the ultrasound training you're doing on Maven, which is a platform that she's using to do trainings. And I'll connect you guys because I've thought about this. I think this would be really good for you. And you'll do really well.
Jill, remind me who I told you that you should follow on social media way before you listened to that show.
Courtney Johnson.
I told you.
I've been stalking you, Courtney.
Yeah, Jill and I had a big conversation about how our Twitter, it just seemed like it was getting to the point where it was just the same few of us talking to the same few of us.
Yeah.
About the same few things.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like going around. And there's value to that, right? Don't get me wrong. I think value in sharing cases. But I've kind of dropped a little bit off of it just because I think it's... I don't see the effervescence of the efforts. And it seems like a very close circle of people that are doing the same thing. And it just doesn't seem to be reverberating at the level that I would like it to.
I think August does a good job at trying to teach instead of just trying to pat themselves on the back. I think
that's the thing. There's a fine line between
most people just pat themselves on the back. Oh, look what I did with this wire and this catheter and this balloon. Mm-hmm. Look at me. I think August and maybe
Lorenzo
Lorenzo. Do more of a job at like, hey, this is how I do it. This is just, you know, this might help you, which is helpful. I mean, everybody else is kind of not doing that.
But anyway, I started telling her that she should migrate to LinkedIn. And that's when I said, you gotta talk to Core.
People do the same thing on LinkedIn.
Europeans, not the gringos.
Yeah, but they do the same patting on the back thing.
That's what I'm telling you. Yeah. So what I found really interesting here is that...
And I've done it. I've done the whole...
For her as an entrepreneur, because that's what she is, right? I mean, she's an entrepreneur. She has her own patents. She has her own thoughts. She's an inventor and a researcher. I feel that there's so much more networking and capacity to be built and to expand in very creative ways in the LinkedIn platforms that may not necessarily be offered by Twitter. But that's a very personal thought. That's why I said
You should take Courtney, you should send her a link to your Maven course.
What have your thoughts been since we've had that discussion, Joe?
Oh, well, this morning I wrote some notes. Tomorrow I'm going to post two cases. And I took Courtney's advice. I just want to share what I've learned and what I know.
Yeah.
So I am going to read her books. Yeah. And once a week, post some cases from an educational and learning standpoint, not just, hey, this is what I'm doing. So I'm excited about that.
That's awesome. Look at you being all excited.
Look at us.
It's a little scary. You know, I don't...
That's a cringe mountain. Gotta get over the cringe mountain.
Totally. And Miguel, I saw you were looking at my LinkedIn profile either today or yesterday. So I...
You guys spy on each other, huh?
I always do that late night.
Is that the type of relationship you like? You just like to creep?
On my... on my intellectual, intellectual crushes.
Yeah, that's okay. I would do the same thing.
All right. So this is a rant about arterialization. It's a topic that seems very near and dear to us. We've been exposed directly and indirectly to this, out of a need, out of an opportunity, but more so a need for our patient care. And you and I have had a couple of ones, and we've had a lot of good feedback about it.
These are some of our best performing episodes, which is crazy. Just us talking. So now it's even with Jill. It's going to be like exponential growth. Like from here to Joe Rogan, I think.
we were told by our producer that we have to talk about other really famous podcasts, so that the AI algorithms would pick up on it and start boosting us.
Oh, we have to appease the AI gods.
All in podcast. Anyway, so we closed our last rant bringing up the fact that we would like to look a little bit more on the post and also of what we've learned about imaging in ultrasound in the setting of these possible arterializations. And of course, who better than the ultrasound queen herself, Miss Jill Somerset. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm so excited to talk about this because, Miguel, as you know, I am super obsessed with ultrasound in general, but really of the foot. I think in this no option type procedure, we have a lot to learn about the pedal venous anatomy. And, you know, I'm constantly texting you images of look at this valve that I saw. This is what I'm thinking. So it's a really exciting time. I think personally, I'm growing a lot, but I really love to talk with you and others about this new area that we're learning so much about that potentially could help learn more about better outcomes and preoperative planning.
So, Lucas, what I know you do arterializations. You do some crazy ones too. What are you asking your non-invasive lab to provide as core baseline information on the imaging side of things that help you
decide? I do it myself because, I have very. It's not that they're not good; it's that they. we don't have a good retention rate. So we have to do a better job at, having our ultrasound specialist engaged and interested. And right now we're, part of me, obviously that I'm part of that process. So I'm failing in that somehow, some way.
Do they work for the vascular surgery division or do they work for the hospital?
They work for the cardiovascular division. And I feel like they really want to be engaged with vascular, but they're pushed and pulled in different directions. And I haven't really found a way to kind of like take one under the wing and just saying, okay, let's do this and convincing administration. Okay. Like this is the person that is going to like spearhead for it, which I would love that to happen. And it will happen at some point. But in the meantime, I'm just doing it myself, which is very poor quality, I must say.
No, so let's move past the logisticals issues that you may have locally. What is it that you look for when you're deciding that this potentially could be a good candidate for a procedure?
Well, I do a venogram, and I look for no fibrosis, no kind of chronic.
So you're thrombus. Not using ultrasound at all in the front end, period.
No, I just don't think I have the skills to get the information I need. I mean, I do look at the vein, obviously, but I think that's very rudimentary. Is that just looking at like, okay, do you have a vein? Does it compress? How big is it? I think there's obviously when you look at the level of things that Jill's doing, I think that I wouldn't come close to that with the ultrasound. So I then just skip right into a venogram, which questionable if it gets that level of detail, but I feel like I'm probably get more information than what I can do with an ultrasound.
So Jill, would you mind expanding as to what at this point you believe should or could be the preoperative protocol on imaging for the potential arterialization?
Yeah. Well, let's back up here because I think that let's just say you do have a tech who's engaged or a team. I think there's some education that we can help enhance if in their knowledge for preoperative mapping. I think we've driven the point home about GSV mapping for bypass. And now, Miguel, we have these illustrations that we had someone draw up for us, but it's really disease pattern recognition. So when you're scanning a CLTI patient and you see the entire PT and lateral plantar artery is occluded, but the anterior tibial is open, more flow towards the foot, the tech maybe should automatically be thinking, well, this could be a venous arterialization case. Therefore, I'm going to map what's the ostial length of the posterior tibial artery and what does the lateral plantar vein look like. Those are two very quick measurements that they could be thinking and pushing you in that direction.
So you're saying if the PT is out and the plantar vessels are out, automatically your predictive index is higher for a no-option patient. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. There's no distal target for bypass. Let's say there's a heel ulcer. I think, and whether or not you're going to do that procedure is up to you, but I think that we can help on the front end of the ultrasound to not only map the great saphenous vein, but also then to do a quick map for a possible DVA.
Can you bill for that?
No. That's just going to, you can, but you have to end your study and then start a new venous study. So it'd be a venous code for mapping.
And they would have to get approval.
So you can bill for two.
They would have to call someone and get approval for that.
Yeah, or you could write it into your policy. You could write it into your policy.
Okay. No, but one thing that I've come to realize in private practice is the low yield things, insurance doesn't give you a lot of pushback. It's more when you come to procedures.
When you have your own shop, but when you have like some big bureaucracy, you have to like kind of deal with that.
Oh, I thought the question was, can you get paid for it? And yeah, the answer
part
is
of the question, yeah.
You can and you will, and there's no need to my knowledge to pre-authorize an ultrasound. And so,
but I think I think a lot of techs would say, I don't have the authority to do another examination without an order.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's easy to.
But if you have it,
change locally.
Yeah, written in your protocol.
I mean, in our shop, they have the authority.
Yeah.
I mean, I give the techs the authority to say, if I need to do another one, then they do another one, and then obviously we have to write in the chart. You know, we have their back, right?
Yeah.
Meaning, if they tell me, "Hey, I went on and I did a pedal venous mapping," then I'm going to write a note to that sense as to why we did it, and of course we're going to go and bill it.
Yeah, right? 100%.
For that purpose. But then specifically for then looking at the patient that you're considering on arterialization, what I would like to know from that standpoint is a few different things on the front end. I want to know what the condition of the veins is, meaning I want to know that they're compressible and there's no evidence of post-thrombotic disease, which it seems to me like now that we're doing more of this, there's probably a lot of patients that fly under the radar with probably, had small vessel DVT, if that's something, right?
Like I think it correlates with the amount of necrosis that you have. The more, I feel like I see it in patients that have more necrosis, more acute necrosis, more possibly wet gangrene. I feel like those patients have a high, I think I've seen it more in those patients than the patient that has one little toe that just has a little spot. I think you should really watch out for that.
Yeah.
So the understanding of what the, diameters, condition, meaning patent or non-patent, thickened or non-thickened, compressible, non-compressible, and then the superficial venous system, wanting to understand the medial marginal vein, greater saphenous vein, small saphenous vein, condition of that, the deep venous system and its condition too.
If you're going to do endo, is the medial marginal important or relevant as relevant as, because you're going to have that the first metatarsal perforator that can go through the AT, that can go through the, there's lateral marginal. Is the medial marginal that relevant? I don't know.
So I like to think of it as a systematic mapping to simplify it. So posterior tibial veins, whether you're doing endo or HISA or open. So what's the condition of the posterior tibial veins? And I compress them down to the ankle. And then I go into the foot and look at the lateral plantar vein. And if it is less than 3, I'll put a tourniquet above the ankle and measure that. And then I'll look at the medial plantar veins as well. And then I go to the top of the foot and look at that foot perforating vein that I think on the last rant that I just listened to. Sometimes it can be accessible, sometimes not. And then I look at the medial marginal vein, diameter and health, and then just go right up to the great saphenous vein and small saphenous vein. So it's just like a pedal venous loop mapping.
Do you look at the actual, structure of the loop? Because sometimes, it can be very varied. And it becomes relevant.
It can be very what?
Varied.
Okay.
What did I say?
Yeah, I just heard very, very. Yeah. Like very, very, very what?
Very, very something.
It can be so very much. Yeah,
so very, very.
Okay.
But it comes into play when you, if you believe in lysing metatarsal vein valves at the index procedure, because it can either allow you to do it or completely hinder you from doing it. And I wonder, when I can't go in and get into a metatarsal vein easily to do it, because I like to do it in index procedure, it's like, man, can I identify this pre-op somehow, some way? Because it's just when you look at a venogram, it's just like a mesh of just contrast. And you're like, oh, I don't know what the hell's going on there, just from shooting at the GSV, which is what I do.
Yeah. I think I can say that when I scan kind of by the heel too, if you access the lateral plantar vein, and sometimes when you go back towards the heel with the wire, you get into like a nest. And sometimes you can see that kind of nest on ultrasound. And then same as if you go towards the ball of the foot, the lateral plantar vein is generally pretty big at the midfoot, and then it can, you know, go into all these branches and it can be a little difficult to track. Yeah. So yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying.
To your previous question, I would say, yeah, I do want to know the integrity of the deep venous and superficial venous system, because I don't come at it already with a bias that I'm going to do endo. I come at it with a bias that I believe that there's no arterial reconstruction that's possible, and that I want to consider doing endo versus open. And so I don't necessarily think the tech should be the person doing that, for making that call for me. I want to know of all of it, you know, what I, now that I'm going to then overlap the angiogram or or also some of the arterial duplex findings, what am I going to talk the patient into? What am I going to consent them for based on what I have? And just to give you an example, you know, I can think of a patient the other day that I had with Jill that, you know, it was a perfect candidate for an open hybrid. Right. And I already in my mind,
because of arterial anatomy.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I already in my mind, I was already somewhat biased that that's what I was probably going to do. Well, the pedal venous mapping came back and he had ablations of the saphenous vein, and the guy didn't even know. He didn't even remember. Then after I kind of poked around a little bit, he's like, oh yeah, somebody many years ago for swelling or something like that. And it was in the venous, and you know, the venous mapping preoperatively, that I was like, okay, well, this one's going to be a tricky one. We're going to have to pull the feeder vessel from the perineal, and you know, because it was this single posterior tibial that you don't want to touch, because otherwise you just knock everything out.
Yeah, that's why
I'm saying. But then the GSV wasn't available.
Yeah.
So then, okay, well, this is going to change. First, I'm going to have to go back to endo.
Yeah.
And
so do you,
instead
do
of pulling it from the PTA, I'm going to have to pull it from the perineal.
Do you do hybrid before perineal inflow?
Do I do hybrid? No, the hybrid is the last of all.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Correct. So, okay. So yeah. So yeah, I do.
Yeah. 100%.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. No, that I got confused. I thought like you saw enough of the perineal, but because you just had a PT, you said, okay, I'll go hybrid, which I don't. Anyways. So pre anything. Anything about which of the two posterior tibial or lateral plantar veins to access? Because somebody mentioned something recently, and I was like, man, I've never thought about that. That might be a thing. You want to give us some insight into that? Or is that not right now?
Well, it's not published yet, but definitely the deeper of the posterior tibial vein seems to have less bridging and, you know, branches coming off of it. So I think that should be the target vein. And always there seems to be a really dominant lateral plantar vein, which is usually deeper. So I think...
How can you follow... How do you know the deeper... What do you mean with deeper? I thought they were one on, like, on each side. Like, there's the posterior tibial, and then there's one anterior and one posterior.
Yeah,
I think this is where it gets tricky, because how do you, you know, guide a wire into the deeper of the posterior tibial veins?
Yeah, because you're not accessing the PT veins, you can, right? You're accessing the lateral plantar. Right. So how do you?
There's not they kind of like some. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy, but I think that when they go like right past the ankle and here into this groove, they kind of like turn, like
extend your arm to the back. That way. Keep going. There you go. Have you found that there's a way to follow it easily down the planner and then sub-select the planner that you should get into so that you get into the right PTV?
Not yet. I don't know.
Because then the problem is this lacune that what did you call it?
There's a
confluence. I call it the lacune or confluence, where all this stuff kind of all gets meshed. And so I'm not sure that it seems easier said than done that you could say, well, I'm going to put my needle here and then the wire is going to go into this particular PT vein.
Well, we love making things more complicated. So.
It just doesn't seem practical. No. But Okay, but I guess that you can...
Somebody's going to publish a paper. It's like, this is the vein you have to stick.
Oh, that's her.
That's her.
That's her, yeah. That's, I think it should be in the oven. It should be in the oven, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
Well...
So that's all on the pre-op. I do think that the PATs
please,
to begin
please
with
interrupt
are...
Us
interrupt anytime. We like to hear ourselves talk and mansplain a lot, so stop us.
He likes to do that.
I've got hate fan message, by the way.
We got one hate message, and it was Miguel mansplaining. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Listen. If they ain't hating, you ain't playing. You know what I'm saying?
I felt very proud. Well,
I was very proud of our first hate message.
Yeah. Anyways, keep
the bearded guy should shut up or something like that.
Like now. Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I guess I have a question for you guys. So let's just say I'm preoperative mapping this patient and the lateral plantar vein is 2.5. And I put a tourniquet up and it's 2.6. It's still super tiny. Is that going to change your mind? Or are you going to do it anyway? So does it matter?
I mean, I think unless it's... No, 2.6, I'll do it.
What about 2?
No. If it doesn't go increase in diameter with a tourniquet, no.
I think it's more about the...
Because the stent is just going to... I don't think the stent's going to lay well. I think it's going to cause injury, neotomoplasia. It's going to go down. It's going to be painful.
If you could put a wire through it, I'm going to try it. That's the essence of it.
That's a Miguel Montero answer.
What I'm saying is I think there are more technically challenging scenarios like tortuosity and
it's
severe...
It's not about technical challenge. It's about, is it going to be effective?
Well, I don't think I have enough data to say that categorically.
I agree.
That's all.
But if you had that in hand,
I'm going to give it a
GSV,
shot.
If you had that and you had a GSV...
I'm going to do a GSV.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. If you tell me there's a 4mm GSV, I'm going to do a HISA.
Exactly.
100% of the time. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think some people have superficial, predominancy. Some people have fat, superficial venous systems.
What were you going to say?
And some people have super athletic deep venous systems, right?
I agree with you, Miguel.
Right?
Yeah.
There's
I totally agree.
Fat. Superficial, and you could see everything, and it's
say fat again.
And then there's these athletic little, and of course, and somehow I think these people are actually the ones that do the best, the ones that have all
100%.
These refluxy veins already, where you do the first angio, and there's digital veins that light up. What in the world? How did this get here?
Because these are the
more chronic ones.
I've found the GSV kind of self-regulates flow volume. I've not seen a flow volume on a GSV greater than 300. Ever.
Now.
Have you seen it, Jill?
That's pretty high.
Oof. I know, it's high. We were saying that was normal in Promise 2. 300 was that's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Now I think it's less than 100.
Oh,
but,
HISA?
Huh?
Are you talking about a HISA?
Yeah, I've not seen flow volumes higher than 300 on HISA.
Well, okay. Well, that's also you're an anastomosis. You make it tiny. You're not making the same anastomosis you do for a bypass.
I'm making the same anastomosis.
Really?
Yeah, 100%.
You don't change your anastomosis technique.
Why? You don't need that much flow. Why would you change it? What are you trying to achieve?
Well, the way that I was taught to do distal bypasses is I like to make a wide mouth in the popliteal.
Really?
Yeah, for a popliteal to DP bypass or a popliteal posterior tibia bypass, you clearly didn't do enough with me. You make a fat, good incision, bro. You make a nice, fat incision in the popliteal.
Yeah, maybe I should go back to the fellowship.
and that gives you really... I noticed is when I did those big, big incisions, there were 500 and 600 volume follows. Mm. And so I stopped doing that.
I guess my incision's better.
Yeah, and your bypasses probably go down quicker. But what I did is I stopped. Mm. I stopped doing incisions with an 11 blade and a POTS. I actually do. I use coronary punches. So the elliptical 4mm coronary punch.
I hate that thing.
To make a perfect hole, and most of these arteries are super calcified anyways.
Yeah.
So it's the best way to do a control of the arteriotomy, and then with that, creating a lumen that's relatively restricted, one-to-one to the GSV. I don't like to make it a bigger one. Like, I don't like to level the GSV.
I thought you were just saying that you made a huge arteriotomy.
When I found the big flow volumes, and so I stopped doing that.
Oh, okay.
So now I do these more contoured, smaller arteriotomies that fit for a perfect end to side with the GSV.
Okay.
I don't vebble the GSV and make this big thing like I normally do on a bypass. I stopped doing that, and now I make a smaller one because I believe the GSV can actually have massive flow volumes.
Okay.
But maybe because...
I don't think, you know, the resistance in a cylinder is length and radius. So that whatever you're, you know...
The size of the proximal anastomosis doesn't have anything to do with the GSV. I mean,
physics
flow?
Are physics. Resistance in a cylinder, I relate it to length and radius. I'm not a mathematician, bro. I'm just saying that's what it is.
Okay, we know what your both of y'all's kid is not going to be in the future.
Yeah,
mathematics is not big in this family. All right, Gio. Let's get back on track. So I do believe that on the preoperative assessment, it's crucial to understand also the baseline hemodynamics of the arterial side.
Okay.
Yes.
Which you don't do other either.
Like what do you mean?
Well, like what's your baseline pedal acceleration times and all that? Because I think
I have no one that does.
I understand, but the rant doesn't. This rant is not about what your problems are. Well, it's about what we all do. Isn't it?
We got to fix that, by the way, Lucas. We need to get those texts.
Are you
trained.
Sending? By the way, are you sending somebody to our course?
I'm trying to get them approved.
You know it's full, right?
I know, but I need to somebody say that, I'm going to pay the $200, which should be more expensive.
Whatever. You should just pay the $200 I should out of your own pocket and send somebody. I mean, come on, $199?
Yeah, but it's a two-day thing. I have to pay for like their housing too, I guess, which is fine.
Well, maybe they have somebody that has family in Houston. Anyway, when's our course? Plug it.
May 9th and 10th, and it's full. Sold out.
Out. It's a course for vascular techs and it's for everybody, but it's... That's we primarily have techs coming. Is that?
Yep, primarily techs. So one physician.
What is this course about? Plug it, because we're going to be doing it times a year. This is just the first one.
Yeah. Well, we're going to call it. It's called Hope Academy, and we'll have a didactic dinner with you, Dr. Lipo, and myself to do a little lecture, and then the next day is hands-on scanning with patients, and we're going to talk about efficient preoperative mapping and thinking like a surgeon or interventionalist and how to map these patients efficiently and quickly, but also teaching pedal acceleration time, which I think is important, of course.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move in the face of care. Intraoperatively. Do you use ultrasound for intraoperatively?
No. Wait. We'll talk about pedal acceleration time and how it informs your decision-making. For this.
All right, go for it, Jill.
Well, I think the question really is for you because we can provide this information about, because usually the lateral plantar artery is occluded by and large in these patients. And I think the medial plantar is actually really important to understand the flow hemodynamics from the arterial standpoint. And usually the anterior circulation PAT is not that bad. So I think what's interesting is now we're looking at the arterial changes after DVA to see if we see changes in the arterial status post DVA.
So
Miguel, you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, before you do that.
Yes, sir.
You have a patient that has a fifth toe wound and you have a DP and AT that are patent and you have a first metatarsal vessel that's open and you opened and you have normal PATs. Yep. Are you not going to do a DVA?
But I would argue then I would put the probe at the fifth toe and look at the fourth dorsal metatarsal artery is occluded.
Well, you can see it in the angiogram. What does that change?
What you're asking is that in the setting of regional ischemia of the foot, is there value for an arterialization when there are areas that are precluded from flow because of these segmental obstructions.
Yeah, because I see why you're trying to, and I think it will get there at some point, that ultrasound screening for the no option patient is a thing. But first you have to get people to believe that, you know, DVA treating a no option patient is a thing first. I understand what you're trying to say, that you can identify these patients on ultrasound. I think we're like way not even close to even be like talking about that, because, you know, you're just going to confuse people even more. I think just convincing people that this, you know, is a disease that can be treated is first in line. And I understand that. I just can see how people can have a normal PAT at the DP and say, yeah, everything's fine, nothing to do, when that fifth toe is never going to heal.
Right. Right. And it's completely devoid of flow.
Yeah.
Now what are you going to do?
Yeah. Because most people encounter these patients on the angiogram, because most people have very poor ultrasound that are not even like looking at the nuances below the ankle. So at that point, you make your decision. At that point, you assess your arterial anatomy, your arterial hemodynamics. And afterwards, you might look at ultrasound, but I think you get introduced to the patient on the table in the angiogram.
Okay. So just to be clear, the pedal acceleration doesn't necessarily, it isn't a vehicle to normalize the anatomy of the pedal arch. It is a vehicle to assess regional capabilities of specific arteries. And it is during, I mean, remember, you do the assessment in multiple vessel sites. And you also come to the realization that after you scan, you can say, for example, the lateral plantar artery is going straight to the fifth, and the PAT at that level is X, Y, or Z. And so it just helps you determine what's going there.
Yeah.
But you can easily come out of this, you know, remove PAT from the, well, a good ultrasound and good pedal ultrasound, you can come out and say, hey, you know, the loop is occluded, or the fifth is occluded. There's no flow directly into that area. And there would probably be benefit in considering an arterialization of this case. So, and you can have an absolutely normal dorsalis pedis with a normal PAT.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't confuse PAT as being the measure by which the anatomy, it's not an anatomical analysis. Yeah. It's really a hemodynamic analysis of the vessel sites. But what I do like about it, to expand on Jill's point, is I like to know what my baseline hemodynamics are and what blood vessels are patent, because those are the blood vessels that are essentially keeping the foot alive, as half dead as it may be when you meet it, right? Yeah. You have gangrene of the forefoot, but the dorsalis pedis is still patent. But also remember that in the setting of an arterialization, you need to optimize everything you can from the native circulation before you create the ischemic shock.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, let's say somebody has an occlusion of the anterior tibial, an occlusion of the posterior tibial, and they have one perineal, and that one perineal goes to what seems to be some trickle flow into the forefoot. And so you say, hey, this guy's going to go on an arterialization. But the perineal has, you know, like a few tight stenosis in the artery. You're going to deal with that ahead, or maybe during the arterialization procedure.
Yeah.
Because we know that that's not going to be maybe enough to get the patient off the table and healthy. But we know that whatever you can improve going into the moment that you create that ischemic shock is going to better the chances of that patient mobilizing through that ischemic penumbra in a more appropriate way. So I like the idea of the ultrasound almost to say, okay, where am I at to begin with? And then can I use this baseline data to compare against what this foot's going to behave in the setting of a change that's so acute and so disruptive in nature, and how much is it going to...
Yeah, playing on that, you know, I just thought about this. You know, that we look at flow volumes as a surrogate for the risk of ischemia. So the higher the flow volume, the higher the risk of ischemia. Instead of looking at that, if you have a, say, a normal vessel that just goes up to the ankle and then it dies, which we see a lot, the pedal acceleration time, can we look at the pedal acceleration time in that vessel where it's relatively normal post arterialization to assess ischemia? Meaning, do you know how the PATs are going to behave if your flow volumes are 500 versus that they are 70? Do you have an idea, Joel? What's the change going to be?
So anecdotally, we look at the PAT every time we scan a foot after DVA. So we're seeing sometimes an improvement in PAT with arterialization. Really? Now, what that means?
Have you noticed the changes during when you've identified ischemia? Say your flow volumes are 400 and the patient's having swelling, discoloration, pain. Have you been curious to look at the PATs at the vessels higher up to see how that changed at all? Because that could be a surrogate.
It'd be interesting to look at. So are you talking about looking at the level of the ankle or in the pedal arch?
You'll look at the angiogram and you'll see, in some patients you have a normal AT that goes up to the ankle and then dies. So you look at it above the ankle and you look at the PATs pre and post. And in the ischemic patient, you know, could you identify something? And do you have any idea what you predict that would be if you have less flow? So your PAT would increase, no?
Not that sure.
Interesting. All right.
I think flow will become a parameter that can help us guide and limit the ischemic penumbra. But I think what's more important is how that flow changes the baseline arterial perfusion. Okay. I can expand on that. When we finish the arterialization, one of the things that we most underline is the importance of looking at the baseline arterial angiogram. So you start the procedure and you look at these, let's say the anterior tibial has a little bit of flow down to the forefoot. At the end of the arterialization, there's going to be three angiographic characteristics, and somebody can just take this and write a paper, because I don't know that I have the patience to do another one. But there's going to be normal pattern of anterior tibial flow, understanding that the AT is the only vessel there, right? So you finish the arterialization and you have a conserved baseline anterior tibial pattern, meaning the DVA and the AT almost go at the same velocity. And there's this, and they go down the screen and they wash at the same velocity.
Yeah.
Number two is the DVA goes fast and then the AT comes down, continues to go down, but it's sluggish.
Yeah. You're in trouble.
And number three is there's no anterior tibial flow. It almost reverses.
Yeah.
And so for me, that is the immediate trigger that this is a high volume flow fistula and that you are getting this patient into trouble. And for me, that is when I consider on-table embolization or on-table ligation of outflow through the medial marginal or the GSV or whatever it is that I want to do, whatever it is that I need to do to, back to your physics, augment the resistance outflow so that the volume flow drops appropriately. So, okay. I think that there is still a margin of error because that's somewhat grotesque, right? Or gross. It's A, B, C. But I think within the A group, and that's where I think we're going to fine-tune this, there may be a group where your PAT remains normal. So you didn't change it at all. Mm-hmm. The PAT of the lifeline mm-hmm. remains normal. Or the PAT of the lifeline drops by 20%. Mm-hmm. Or the PAT of the lifeline drops by 80%. And I think that that's something that you can do on the table. Now, what's really important to do when you're thinking about this is that your baseline PAT is without a sheath. So if you're going to start thinking about this, make sure that you do a baseline PAT
with a sheath
after you put the sheath.
Yeah.
Because when I was in that oxygen mm-hmm. microsensor company 10 years ago, one of the first things that drops the oxygen perfusion to the tissue while doing a procedure is the placement of an antegrade sheath. Because it's an 80% constraint of the luminal, of the SFA's lumen. And by doing that, you immediately drop. So whatever, you can't expect the on-table PAT to be comparable to the PAT when there's nothing in the vessel proximally. It has to be adjusted.
Can you do PATs with a regular ultrasound that you have in the OR?
Yes,
easy.
Because I always call like the big old ultrasound. Anyways, but I think surgeons
need to... Fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Surgeons need to do to be able to do PATs, I think, because I think that there we need to find there is going to be a correlation between flow volumes and PATs. I mean, there's going to be just because of what you see. And I actually have been a little more aggressive than what you just mentioned. If they don't have continuous flow down, then I know my flow volumes are greater than 100. Obviously, I confirm with the ultrasound. But I know I'm going to coil. So I immediately have to, bring the coil card in. Let's do the whole thing. Everybody rolls their eyes.
What is it that you're...
If the AT and the arterialized circuit don't come down exactly at the same velocity, I know that my flow volumes...
So if the AT is relatively sluggish-er... Just even if it's a little bit, you're already coiling.
I'm already thinking about it. I'm calling the coil card in. I'm going to confirm with the ultrasound, but I'm going to coil probably.
Well, that's...
And are you just taking your flow volume in like the distal conduit?
I'm taking the flow volume just at the end of the stent.
That's okay.
Where do you take it?
So that's a class two. Class one, they come at the same time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Class two, the AT is a little bit sluggisher. Class three,
the Montero Baker classification.
Yeah, I mean, maybe before I die, somebody will coin it.
I will name something in your honor.
I would love
someday.
It from now on. Yeah. People just say, "Hey, I did this arterialization. It's got an MB class one. That means they're both at the same time. The flow is normal. Yeah. You don't have to worry. MB two, it's sluggish. I'm going to coil. MB three." 100%, you got a coil, right, and maybe embolize.
Let's just write the
paper. And maybe
let's
like
just
it.
Write the paper and name it after yourself.
And I've learned about IP. Now it doesn't. As long as it's out there before, I can always fight the next guy.
Okay, that's good.
Here's the deal. The funny thing is we say PAT, PAT, and I love Jill because of that, but. Like, who cares, right? At the end of the day, what I do think is surgeons should be looking at the waveforms, period. Like, who cares if you can measure it or not? If you started off with a peaky, good waveform, and all of a sudden you do the procedure and your flow volumes are
the problem is what 200. You just said, peaky. Like, what is peaky?
I know, but what I'm saying is some of these more rudimentary ultrasounds.
Yeah, you're going to be at M&M saying, man, it just looked really peaky. I don't know what happened.
I'm saying there's a qualitative.
ESL, yep.
Not only ESL, but my third modelo. Qualitative. There's a qualitative analysis, yes. Qualitative, and then that alone should be enough. Like, if all of a sudden it's tardis parvis, there's a problem, right? Forget the whole thing. I don't know if I can measure it. I don't know where, like, the button for this. Fine. Look at the waveforms. Take a picture. Put it on your iPhone, and then look at the waveform at the end. Is there a difference? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. Then do something. Because if you leave the room
with a change
in the waveform...
If you leave... Okay.
The waveform should look the same before and after.
Okay.
The waveform of the baseline artery that's perfusing the foot.
It should look the same.
Yes.
You think so? What does that flow volume usually?
That's what I don't know.
I don't know.
That's what I don't know, because I don't think that we've done enough of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a call to action for everybody out there that cares about this. Would you please just? Well, no, she doesn't have enough cases.
Aren't you doing a bunch of cases?
I'm not doing a bunch of cases, and she's not there when I do them.
Okay.
She's a listen. What's the difference between Jill Somerset and God?
I don't know.
Okay, God is all over the world.
Yeah.
Okay. Jill Somerset is all over the world, minus hope. So she's too busy going to the Maldives. She speaks in the Maldives. She speaks in Australia. Damn. Then the next day she wakes up in Argentina. Then she's talking about PAT and Saturn and Jupiter. And then sometimes she's with Mary, but Mary never sees. She's like the Halley Comet, man. I mean, it's like amazing to just get a glimpse of her. So anyway,
that must be nice. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like traveling.
That must be nice.
I don't envy you, to be honest. I'm past that.
I do.
I hate traveling.
Well,
I like to be at home.
Maldives?
Yeah. Well, Maldives for a talk. I'd go to Maldives for a talk. Maldives for a talk. I'd bring Jen and Lucas, though. Anyway, okay, let's get back. The rant's going forever. I feel like how people stick to this shit.
I have no idea.
How can they be the biggest target?
I have no idea. So I think they're getting more unhinged.
We're going to
more
than
post-op. Let's go to post-op.
Well,
okay.
Axis?
Not really. Okay,
Axis. What about Axis and or closure? Ultrasound. I'm just talking about the value of ultrasound in the operative phase. I think Axis is important.
Super.
Is importantísimo. I think Axis is importantísimo. We haven't done a show in Spanish in a while, so that's my. But I think that's it.
You brought me back to it. Since I've been using the Kelt, I just use.
Are you using Kelt to close the lateral planner?
No, I just do balloon angioplasty and like balloon angioplasty.
Well, I had a really bad axis site complication. That's what I'm saying. I mean, maybe that's not a bad idea.
Yeah. I wouldn't do it.
So what happened is I've had two large hematomas in the plantar surface and there's not a lot of space there.
Yeah, that's.
And so one of them actually necrosed the skin and we had to carve it out and then we skin grafted. I mean, it did fine, but it was a sizable complication that I think we could have prevented. By having something. You told me you put a secondary wire and then you balloon and you hold pressure and that's been enough. And I started doing that and it's really nice. It's actually very...
change something you did?
Yes, you did. Wow. Yes, you did. I learned a lot of things from Lucas. Specifically about self-control. Not. all vascular things and not.
Yeah.
How long do you hold the balloon up for, Lucas?
Same thing you taught me, three to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
2-3 minutes. Nice.
60% of the time it works 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think, or just have the resident just put their finger on it.
I'll put a stitch there sometimes.
I think that can cause a problem, though.
Maybe.
I think it's better just to let it bleed and coagulate eventually.
I guess so. I guess that's probably what putting a stitch in the skin is what retained the hematoma inside.
Yeah, if it's oozing a little bit, just let it be. By the end of the case, it's done.
Yeah, I just hate nurses call.
Yeah.
They call a lot. Okay, so, we're done. We came out of the procedure. We checked flow volumes. We checked PAT we looked at angiography. We modulated the flow. We came out of the thing. We feel a little better. And now we go home. And now what is your timeline to bring that patient back for your outpatient follow-up?
Well, I get an intra-op flow volume and I get a immediate post-op flow volume. So I'm sending...
How many times is there a change? What's up? Sorry, Jill. What's up?
Oh, I'm just going to ask, intraoperatively, do you get a lateral plantar vein flow volume or are you just going for the distal conduit at the end of the
distal stent? Conduit. I mean, that
so how come not lateral plantar vein?
Because it goes to other places, and then that's not your flow volume, right?
Mm-hmm. I think there's some value in it
What I'm thinking is ischemia. It's not like, am I driving perfusion?
Where do you land your stent?
Upper calcaneus.
Well, everything
but there's always that
below
short...
the calcaneus is already the lateral plantar, anyways, no?
Yeah.
So what's the I guess I missed the question. What's the difference between the edge of the stent and the LP? The edge of the stent should be in the LP.
True, but you oftentimes have that early branch that goes right to the GSV, and yeah. I think that can steal a lot of flow. So I like to, if I could be in a perfect world in every case with you, Miguel, I would look at the lateral plantar vein intraoperatively as far distally as I can, because then you know how much is stealing off that early branch.
Well, at that point, you're coming up with theories about mechanism of action, and we have no idea what the mechanism of action is. Anecdotally, you know, I've seen rest pain go away, so anecdotally, mm-hmm. there might be a perfusion thing, like a retrograde, but mm-hmm. the truth is we don't know mechanism of action. So, I mean, I guess it could be important if the mechanism of action is retrograde perfusion.
100%.
But mm-hmm. That's just an opinion. I think what is important and the only information I want to know is, am I stealing at that moment? Because the rest, I have no idea what's going on. In those 3 months, I don't know what's going on. Mm. Nobody knows. Mm. So what I want to know is, am I stealing? And that's why I look at the edge of the stent.
I do the same. I look at the edge of the stent, which in my case, the more I do, the more I push it forward. So I feel like I'm out of the LP vein anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? The more you do, the more you push up. Why?
Because because I preclude the high volume flow states, and mm-hmm. it minimizes the need of overly complicated embolization so that the staff doesn't roll their eyes.
Yeah.
So I just push the stent past the calcaneus, almost into the midfoot.
I keep it mm-hmm. up because I feel like a significant amount of these patients is going to get that neonatal hyperplasia before the 3 months. So eventually I'm going to put another stent distally. So I want a runway for when it starts failing because of that neonatal hyperplasia, I have some place to go with another stent.
That's kind of like saying, I'm not sure I want to go and watch the movie because I might not like it.
Yeah.
That's kind
of
weird.
That's the type of person.
You want to go watch that movie? Well, what if I don't like it? Well,
I'm a glass person, I guess.
All right. So, but anyway, I do look at the edge and I take a volume. And do you aim for 100 or less?
100 or less.
100 or less.
Yeah. Because I didn't know this. I was like, oh, what is the flow volume of a normal vessel? And it's like low teens.
Oh, you mean like a non-fistula,
like a normal AT? I think I chat GPT'd that.
So you take your flow volume on the table, Lucas, and let's just say it's 200 and it's too high. What are you going to do?
I'm going to take a shot at 6 frames mm-hmm. per second.
And what if it was MB Flow 1? I'm starting a thing. I'm starting a thing.
I'm still going down to 100.
With MB Flow 1?
Yeah, with MB Flow 1.
Okay. And I agree with you.
Yeah.
But that's where I tease it out with a PAT, because if it's MB Flow 1
yeah.
with an unchanged PAT,
yeah.
I believe that patient can take 250 to 300 and nothing will happen.
Okay.
Nothing.
Why would you even risk it?
What? Because contrast and your procedure 2-3 times longer?
Contrast.
Yes, there is a reason why you would like to personalize care. I don't think it's going to be a flow volume number. I think it's going to be personalized. Every patient,
that's fine, but
your 200 yeah. is her 100, is her 180.
That's fine, but we're not there yeah. yet. So
but this is where this is I'm going.
The safe
I think thing, yeah. MB1 is going to be then teased out to MB1 with or without PAT alterations.
We're publishing so, Miguel, this paper. This has to be a thing.
Yeah, MB1, we're writing MB2, it as, MB3. Exactly. Because just to be clear, though, you're talking about a native arterial PAT, right?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. If that's unchanged or decent, that patient can take a
Who
higher
cares?
Flow volume.
Yeah. They'll, okay. Because listen, all through PROMISE 2, nobody was checking this shit.
No, I know.
And yeah. I bet you more times than none.
ESL number 2.
There was the flow rates were probably 200 to 300.
Yeah.
and still those patients did fine.
Yeah, and we were still talking about the DVA storm. I think once we
DVA storm is ischemia from these high volume flows, period.
Once we bring it down below 100, there's no DVA storm.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Controversial.
Okay. Well, listen, here's the deal. We talked 1 hour about the perioperative mm-hmm. care, and we got to the procedure, but we didn't get into. But that's okay, because that means that we get Jill another time. Then we can do a post-procedure and then just focus on post-procedure volume flows. Because I'd like to listen from you both on when do you do your first ultrasound. Okay, you said the next day. But to that point, and we'll wrap it with that, but like you did the flow volume analysis on the table. You embolized. You got it down to where you want it. You check it the next day, is up again. Do you bring him back again? What do you do?
Who knows? Is Mercury in retrograde then?
Okay. So you're doing the second one just for research purposes. Like you're not.
I'm gathering data.
Correct. You're not putting reacting.
Excel spreadsheet.
But you're not reacting. Who knows what happens? The only reaction is your initial one is one mm-hmm. that's, and then maybe some post-operative clinical changes that are not great. Right.
Yeah.
Because let's say you did come out with 100, and let's say the guy that night or the patient that night had severe pain.
They're going back.
The foot doesn't look great.
If they have pain in the back, they're going right back to the OR.
Immediately.
That's when you lose it.
And what do you do?
Whatever I need to do.
Well, I mean, embolized.
I increased the.
I was giving you a layup. I wanted you to say, I already embolized everything I could. My next step is ligation of the GSV. That's what I wanted you to say.
Oh, well. I'll ligate the GSV.
You don't? What do you do?
Before you told me about it, I coiled it.
Oh, so you would coil the GSV?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the first thing I coil. If the flow volumes are high, just go straight for the money.
Do you ligate it at the MMV, though? You ligate it down below, right? Right at the edge? Oh, you actually go all the way up into the ankle?
Yeah.
What about the MMV? Why don't you just ligate the MMV a little bit lower?
Because I don't want to wound. Here,
I'm sorry. Why don't you embolize?
Because I don't want to wound.
You don't coil embolize the MMV. You coil embolize the GSV.
Ferraresi told us don't coil in the dorsal part because you get a wound. And whatever that guy says, I just take it to like the bank.
I've never seen a coil erode through the skin.
I don't know. In my life. He's probably done more than you. So he's probably seen a couple more. Has. Yeah. Sure so has. I'm like, okay. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Jill. welcome to the rant. Any closing arguments, any closing comments, any closing questions that we should leave up in the air for next time?
Well, I think we have a lot to talk about for post-op, so I'm excited to come back. Yeah. And I think this is where the ultrasound part is so incredibly important for the post-op care. So I look forward to DVA rant 4, and maybe even Dr. Lipo can join us.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That is actually a good idea. We'll mesh the wound care and the surveillance all into
and
one.
We'll leave it right at like this time. We won't be able to finish, and it'll just be
we won't get like past week one. Yeah. All of what you have to do, and it gets you to week
the
one.
The viewership, the downloads are going to go like straight down. It's like, please get to
welcome the rant. 1 million and a half.
This will just,
listen, you're a friend of the podcast. I appreciate you. We appreciate you. We hope to see you here again.
Yeah. You should come to Austin.
Thanks, you guys. With us.
She was here yesterday.
I was just there.
I know. We'll make it work better. No. Oh, well, the next one's in Houston. Maybe we can make it when.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, enero, febrero. I can't count or do months in English. Enero, febrero, marzo, abril, mayo. Wait. I have an idea. May is our course, right? Mm-hmm. He's coming to our course in May. May is in 2 months from now. We should do the recording in May at Hope.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, guys.
That would be excellent. Okay.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.